So it's been kind of fun. A lot of you guys know that we do a lot of team teaching. Allie crushed it last week. Anybody disagree with that? You can send your complaints to, what's that website? No, I'm just kidding. But and then a couple weeks ago before that, Danny preached. And one of the things that was, how many remember the date that he preached on? Anybody? Anything stand out from you in your memory?
Like, first, you mean the date that he
actually preached on? 9/11. Yeah? What's that? It was 9/11, right? And he reminded us of the substantialness of 9/11 and back in the day when 9/11 happened. How many of you guys remember 9/11? Right? So 9/11, of course, is when the Twin Towers were bombed. I don't think I got to explain that too much, do I? You know, probably not. But in any case, for the younger guys, I don't know if you understand, but there was a cultural shift when that happened. Does anybody remember?
Everyone liked America.
What's that?
Everyone liked America.
It was all right. We were, like, it brought people together. It was, something changed, but there was also an element of it that changed, that we all of a sudden realized that we're not safe. Right? That we can be hit. Now, what's ironic about it, now, hear me very carefully, about 5,000 people, roughly, depends on how you count. That includes the workers that went there and got sick from the thing, and you know, because the inhalation and all that kind of stuff is roughly around 5,000 people. Okay, so in the course of the world, that's not a huge number, right? But it's not the number that mattered as much as the event and the vulnerable feeling. Are you tracking with me? The shift in what all of a sudden we were experiencing. And then what comes out afterwards with all the media and all that stuff? Well, first of all, you have a moment of sobriety where you're getting like real time, like the media people finally weren't like sensationalizing. They were just like, oh my goodness. And they were in it in a way that was sobering. And like it was interesting to do that. And I always like to tell the story of when I came home, because I went in the morning and I had school all day and all this stuff going on. And I come home trying to kind of catch up on the day. I'm in BBC, so British Good Morning England or London or whatever it was, because they're 8 hours ahead of us. And I'm watching it at midnight or whatever it was. And they're interviewing people in Barstow. And the way that I make that up is in Barstow, they had people in L.A., doing whatever they were doing, and they couldn't get to New York by airplane because they shut down all of the airplanes. So my imagination says they got on the road and started heading to LA or to New York from LA, and they call in, hey, let's get a report from you guys, and they're just pull over to the local bar and get the. So in Barstow, this is how, you know, so London's view of what's going on in America was in, you know, this little town of Barstow. That just makes me laugh. It has nothing to do with any of what I'm saying, but I love that story. But it was that sobering feeling. And then after that, after people started getting some feet underneath them and everybody starts writing to try and figure out what happened. And we get the conspiracy theories, and it was an inside job, and it was, you know, all of the, you know, no matter where you land on all of this stuff, you know, you get all the times when, you know, I remember watching a CNN special where Clinton could have taken Bin Laden out, but the problem was he was dealing with Monica Lewinsky, and just all these different, like, connections, like, start coming up, and it's all hindsight stuff, right? It's all stuff that, how many of you guys have had a catastrophic event? And then you start thinking of, and you would be perfect for this, but all of the chain, what are they? No, what I'm saying is the chain, I forget, but it's called the chain there's like a chain of things that happen. It's never, the event itself has a bunch of little events that lead up to it often, but they don't always connect until afterwards. Does that make sense? And so we're all mad at our government for not figuring this stuff out, but it's because hindsight puts those things together. Like, you can't possibly hear or listen to everything that's going on. But you're sitting there in the rubble of it, trying to kind of work out what's happening. I don't think we've had any major events since then, though, have we?
Well, COVID.
Oh, yeah, that one. Yeah. Right? So that's, yeah. So I set you up. You knew that. Okay. But truthfully, that is a similar kind of thing. And then it's platonic. Platonic in its shift in our culture, is it not? And one of the major events, because of the wind, it's coming right through here. One of the and I love it. It's because it's very nice and cool. But if it's really bothering you, I'll shut the door. But it's a platonic shift of events that takes place. And in the epicenter of that was what? The George Floyd thing. That right there was like, I mean, all of the stuff around it were huge and big and by itself would have been there. But then you have the whole thing by, you know, this tragic event that happens. And all of a sudden, we're left as a society trying to figure out, we've lost our sense of institutions. We can't trust institutions. We can't trust all of our certitudes, right, are going out the window. Let's see, I wrote a couple things down here. We begin to question all of our certitudes, institutions. All of these things are accelerated. And, of course, our faith and our belief in government, law, those carrying out the law are suddenly in question. I'm not putting aspersion on good or bad on these things. It's just that it happened. You understand that it's happened. But we do rush. How many of you guys rush to blame, guilt, shame? All of that stuff starts going off and you start trying to put together and you see all the events that you think you should have seen or should have prepared for or should have had, and now all of a sudden you're trying to play catch up. And all of this stuff is coming. So all of this to set up the year 587 BC. Who knows what happened? The 587 BC. This is right downable if you guys are tracking. The fall of Jerusalem. So yes, Babylon and Egypt are now exporting all of the people and the siege happens, right? And so there's all of these people who are sitting in this platonic event trying to figure out what happened. Now, something I've learned this week, especially, and over the last couple of weeks, is the Bible is actually born out of this. So much of what we read, and it's them trying to make sense. It doesn't mean that the stories weren't there. It doesn't mean that there wasn't, the poetry and all of these different things. But now it's a place where people are trying to, like, it starts to get codified, right? And starts to put it together. And you get poetry like Jeremiah writing to like try and make sense of this. And that's just like, this is what God's view is. And this is what, you know, the prophet's view. And he's going back and forth. And you get all of these different people coming in. And all of these writings, there's tons of them throughout the time. But the prophets of Yahweh, or what's the other one? The Elohim. There's all these different ways that they use the name God, right? Their centering line, their canon, if you will, was based on one crucial thing, and that was covenant with God, covenant with Yahweh, covenant with, say the word again? Elohim, right? So that is what makes it into what we have as our canon of Scripture. It gives them a starting place. If you want to have a Bible, if you guys have a Bible and want to turn over to 2 Kings 23. It gives just the sweeping overview of what happened here. And we're just going to touch on it, but I'll just kind of show you some highlights. 2 Kings 23. How are we so far? Are you tracking with me? Like, you know, like all of these pieces, all of this stuff is going through, and now they're trying to make sense of it, much like we're trying to make sense of 9/11, trying to make sense, you know, like all of the police reform conversations and all of the different things that are going on to try and figure out. They're grabbing for stability. They are in a faith crisis. This God has, in some sense, left them, or at least there's some call into question, for at least their experience is this, right? 2 Kings chapter 23, it says, the king directed that all the elders, so this is Josiah, and Josiah's coming in after a bunch of bad kings. Manasseh is one of the major ones, and just they disregarded Yahweh, they disregarded his words and the principles and all that kind of stuff. And so this king comes in and he's directing that all the elders in verse 1 of Judea and Jerusalem should be gathered to him. And the king went up to the house of the Lord, and he went with all the people of Judea and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem and the priests and the prophets and the people and both small and great. And they read, and he read in their hearing all the words of the covenant. What is he doing? He's grounding them back into who they are, right? And this has been found in the house of the Lord. The king stood by the pillar, and he made a covenant before the Lord to follow the Lord, keeping his commandments and his decrees and his statutes, and with all his heart and all his soul to perform the words of the covenant that were written in this book. And all people joined in the covenant. And the king commanded, we'll pause there. And well, he commanded him, to, like he brings them all back home, right? He's bringing, like, this is our grounding spot. But you also got to remember that this is written after the siege on Jerusalem. So this author who's writing is writing in hindsight, saying that this is the king. This was the good king that tried to get things back on track. But he comes into play, and just some rough dates if you want to write them down, he comes into play in 626 BC, and he lasts for until 609. And then you have Joaz, and he's there for 3 months. He's only a little kid. But then Joachim, and he tries to help things out. But you go through these last three pages, and you see how it doesn't come together, and it doesn't hold. Because if you skip down to verse 23-26, again, they're writing in hindsight. Still the Lord did not turn his fierceness of the great wrath by which his anger was kindled against Judah because of all the provocations with Manasseh who had provoked him. The Lord said, I will remove Judah out of my sight as I have removed Israel, and I will reject this city that I have chosen, Jerusalem, and the house which I said, my name shall be there. So all of this cultural tidal wave is taking place, and all of the good things this guy tries to do to set things right can't stop the tidal wave that's already in place. Babylon is coming, and Egypt as well. And they're going to start shipping these people out all over the place. And these people start hurting, and they start sitting in this, and they're discombobulated and confuzzled. That's my daughter's new word, confuzzled. I think it's a Winnie the Pooh word or something like that, but it's fun. But the main concern that we have here is that the city was ransacked and many were taken to Babylon and Egypt, and there were a few left sitting in the rubble as they watched their temple and sacred faith essentially get carted off. So just imagine you're sitting there in the rubble of your life, whatever that looks like. You have no power, no control, and you're sitting there, and you can picture, if you want, some of the scenery of 9/11 or whatever you want to do, just to kind of, or even, you just look at Ukraine, right? All the pictures that are coming in for Ukraine, and, you know, just seeing things just getting carted out, right? So over in chapter 26, the actual experience of this, verse 13, 2 Kings 26, is that right? Yeah, me either. I know. Let's try verse 13 of 25. That'll work. The bronze pillars that were in the house of the Lord, as they started taking all these things out, right? Did I start early enough? But the captain of the guard left some of the poorest people in the land to be the wine dressers and the tillers. And the bronze pillars were in the that were in the house of the Lord, as well as the stands and the bronze sea and the house of, that were in the house of the Lord. And the Chaldeans broke in pieces. And they carried bronze to Babylon, and they took away the pots, the shovels, the snuffers, the dishes, the incense, everything that was worth money. They just grabbed. And it's just you see these all the time in these pictures, and maybe you've experienced where just like anything they get their hands on, they're just taken out of the place. The bronze vessels used in the temple service, as well as the fire pans and the basins. What was made of gold, and the captain of the guard took away for the gold, and what was made of silver for the silver, and for the two pillars, and the one sea, and the stands which Solomon had made for the house of the Lord. The bronze, all of the vessels, was beyond weighing. The height in one pillar was 18 cubits. Just like this, these things are substantial, iconic things that had their established faith. This was where they came to find grounding. When things were going out of control, this temple stood, much like you would think, you know, Washington, D.C., right? Like, if they would have bombed the White House, that would have been significant in the sense that that was a symbol that would have that we've got stability. And to some degree, certainly those towers represented that to a lot of people, especially in the financial world, in the Western, you know, economy and so forth. And you probably don't have to imagine much, but how would you feel if all of your world is no more? Everything is shifted underneath your feet. All you counted on and you held as stable is now in question. And for these folks, it's the case that it's now gone. Just think of the feelings of fear, failure, despair, loss, sadness, denial. They all stand in the place where hope and joy once were. Israel was in ruins, this great nation. If you want to flip over to Lamentations chapter 1. We won't go through the whole book, of course. And in chapter 1 of Lamentations, verse 1, it said, "How lonely sits the city that once was full of people. How like a widow she has become. She that was great among the nations, she that was a princess among the provinces, has become a vassal. She weeps bitterly in the night with tears in her cheek among all of her lovers. She has no one to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They have become her enemies. Judah has gone into exile with suffering, hard servitude. She lives now among the nations and finds no resting place. Her pursuers all have all overtaken her in the midst of her distress. The roads to Zion mourn, for no more comes the festivals. All her gates are desolate. Her priests groan, her young girls grieve, and her lot is bitter. Her foes have become masters of her, have become the masters, and her enemies prosper." And get this, it's because the Lord has made her suffer, and her multitude of her transgressions, her children have gone away captives before the foe. It goes on to say that the people groan. It says in one part, "My eyes weep and they flow with tears. Everywhere they look, the rug was pulled out from underneath them." And as a point in this passage, this poet takes their complaint and says, "You know what? This is your fault, God. You have done this to us." And not only, not necessarily in a blaming sense, like in a resignation, although maybe, but in the sense of he takes it to where the point, like who could have stopped this? And you just think about the grief that we experience in our lives. There's this thing that we come up to and we just go, "Yeah, God, you could have stopped this. Why did you not intervene? How come this is happening?" This is Lamentations. It's one of those moments where they can recall exactly where they were sitting when the event happened that changed their lives. How many of you guys can do that? When you receive the test score that maybe you were hoping for? That's come up a few times. Where things turned out less desirable, maybe not even passable. We've experienced friends moving and leaving. What about the gavel falling on that DUI charge? Or the divorce papers being slid across the table? Or the doctor walking into the room with that diagnosis? These are platonic shifts in our heart, in our psyche. It is this place of scattered lives and substantial doubt and dissidence. It is in this place where we need an anchor. All loss relativizes us. All loss. Remember Adam Ayers talks about how there's a mobile, right? Like he talks about everything is in relative. So you take something away from a mobile, like you pictured the Taj Mahal, and then it has to do all of this kind of stuff. It's decombobulizing, right? Like it's all over the place until finally it kind of settles, right? Or you add something on over here and the same thing, and it's all over the place. But the question is, where is the anchor for your soul? We sang about it, didn't we? What was the song? What's that line? You are the anthem of my heart. You are the anchor of my soul. So the feelings of despair, fear, failure, loss, sadness, denial, they all are here in this little spot. But then enters our new series. We're going to go through Genesis. I don't know why I'm crying. I know why I'm crying, because I know what I'm about to say, but it's like, it's this anchor that out of the ashes and out of the chaos, God has chosen a people, this people, FWC, to breathe life into and to raise up and to bring order to the mess that we call our lives. The mess that society is happening and the mess is in our individual lives. Hebrews says the hope that we have is this anchor for our soul. And in Genesis 1:1, it says what? God created. God created. My thesis for this series, we're going to do this for about till Easter, roughly, give or take. Depends on how it goes. We're going to have Advent in there. We're going to have our Sundays, intercession Sundays. But we're going to go through and ground ourselves into the fact that you and I are called with a purpose. You cannot talk about the creation without talking about the Creator. They go hand in hand on that mobile. The thesis, again, is that we are God's people, that God calls a special people, faith worship community, to be God's special people of faithfulness. God's call is to be that special people, and it's based on God's call to all the worlds, that's to say creation. He spoke all of it into being. God's call is life and vibrance. He calls that into being. He calls it into being, not us. We get all excited and trying to figure out how to bring life out of stuff. And you know that I'm right up in front, right there with you. Like, how do we bring life? But it's when we sit in it and we wait and we hold into the chaos and trust and let the discombobulation and the confuzzledness move on the waters. He speaks life. And he speaks life into you and me. The basis of that life is promise. Like he calls us, right? The calling is for us, so he calls, we respond. That's the relationship. And the substance of the calling is promise. And that promise primarily is that he will be with us until his purposes are created, are finished, are done. He is not going anywhere. He's like this great painter who just has to, he has to create. He has to. That's just what's, it's in him. He can't hold back. He wants to create and he makes things and he goes through the whole deal and he makes the humans and we screw it up. And so what does he do? He doesn't stop creating. He kind of like cleans off the canvas a little bit. We're going to go through this, right? The cycles of the flood and all of these different things. So he swipes the, and then what does he do? He recreates and then repromises. And then he moves forward into that. It's mystery. It's unbeknownst to us why he creates. We don't understand it. We get little glimpses of it because we know who we are and we know our desire to doodle and, you know, create and think and figure out puzzles and all of these different things. But he creates. He creates and he doesn't stop creating. And our job is simply to respond and allow him to recreate us. And to be faithful and to sit still in the messy part of the confuzzledness. I just like that word. So we're going to go through this, and I'm just going to give you a little overview on these different things. He calls vibrance. We tend to, try and control things with our thoughts and our emotions and our way of being. We try and force it. He says, no, just simply surrender and just respond when I call you forth. And then when we screw that up, guess what? He fixes it and works it again. We get to learn and we get to allow the void to sit. And we have to sit in the ashes a little bit sometimes. And we have to do the surrendering and wait and allow him to create from that place. Like Israel after the destruction of Jerusalem, we are reminded to be his people. Our primary identity is that we are to be faithful. And that we're at least to wrestle with this identity. Like, I'm not faithful, you're not faithful, but we're called to be faithful. And then guess what? The Spirit of God comes in and we become what? Faithful. It's not our doing, but yet we participate. And when he says, let there be life, we allow life to spring forth. We are rushing to make his words reality. To be his people, we are to be responsive to his call. He calls creation into being and he calls us. And the connection is that calling and answering and that we are listening and responding. Over and over again, his promise is to stay and to just to make his until his way is accomplished. Genesis as a book, all the way through, it sets the stage for, it's a grounding point for all of Jerusalem, all of the Israelites, and echoes all the way down to us. It's like this poem in some ways, and it returns to the meaning of the way things ought to be, but it also helps us to look forward to where there will be no more tears. We get to look forward to the day that he's going to reset us. And we don't know what that's going to be. So he's got this idyllic kind of creation that he made for us. He's got this Garden of Eden. He's got this place of like perfection. But we're long, long way away from that, aren't we? So what is he going to do with that? Well, this is a creative God. He's having fun. He's in it with us. And let's see what he comes up with to get to that place of no more tears. I went to a funeral this last week. There's a poem, and I should have probably got the poem for us, but it's all about, have anybody heard the poem, The Dash, at a funeral? So basically this guy, he lived 100 years, he was on his 100th birthday, we had this event, and he was part of the crew that attacked, he was the second wave that attacked into Normandy, and then he was up with Patton and all those, and they rolled half tracks and all that kind of thing. And so it was kind of just history, like right there, and living with us and all that. And it was cool. There was just a lot of cool things. But the guy reads this thing called The Dash. And the guy lived, 100 years, 22 minus, 1922, right? That would be 100 years. So he's got, on his thing, 1922 dash 2022, right? And there's this whole poem written on that, life is what happens on that dash. And we're in this great cosmic dash, that God is writing his life in our souls. He's writing just amazing things that if we're willing to let him do that, we can see life grow out of us. So far, so good. You tracking with me? So we're going to be ministered by the word of God through this. And we're going to let it do what it's intended to do. We're going to work through it in four sections. If you want to write this down, we're going to talk about first the sovereign call of God. The sovereign call of God. And that's going to be, I'll just tell you the bullet points. Sovereign call of God. Then we're going to talk about the embraced call of God. So the sovereign call of God is going to be Genesis 1 to 11. And it's going to deal with all of the, the creation story and the flood and Babylon and all that. We're going to kind of highlight. We're not going to read every word of it. There's some different things that we'll touch on. And then the next part is going to be the embrace call of God. So we're going to read about Abraham and his responsiveness to God and how he stepped into that. And I'll read a couple of notes on this before we move on today. Then I lost the other one. But the other one is the struggle call of God. And that's Jacob, the wrestling, the key one there, where he wrestles with God, if you remember. So we'll work into it, the wrestling with that, you know, how do we be his people and how do we struggle through that together? And then the last one's going to be Joseph's call. And Joseph is titled the hidden call of God. And you remember the famous verse, or maybe you don't, but at the end there it says, what man meant for evil, God meant for good. Remember, his brother sold him into slavery, and we'll work through that together. So we'll touch on these things. But for today, if you want to turn over to Ephesians chapter 1, verse 9, this is under the sovereign call of God. For he has made known to us in all wisdom and insight the mystery of his will, according to his purpose, which he set forth in Christ, as a plan for his fulfillment of time, to unite all things in him, in heaven and on earth. We get to interact with the tension of God's will for us and God and the call of creation in the mixed way in which creation responds to his will. We don't do it simply. It would be nice if we did, I think, in some ways. We will look at his cycles of restoration and the new creating, the over and over again creator and artist. We're going to look at the, like I said, the embraced call of God. In Abraham, we find that in Hebrews, it says, by faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which was received as an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was to go. A little later, it says, by faith, Sarah herself received power to conceive, though she was past the age of conception, since she considered him faithful who had promised. And by Abraham, a little later down, verse 17, when he was tested, he offered up Isaac, who had conceived the promises, and he was ready to offer up his own son. And then later it says, and he was considered that God was able to raise even men from the dead. Henceforth, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. And these passages all focus on Abe's responsiveness to God and his willingness to believe in spite the odds. So we'll focus on faith and trusting in the promise and the heir. Abraham is the one who embraces the call. The primary dramatic movement is in here, and this is the promise that was given. I will make you, and let's hear this for ourselves. And in some sense, this is a call and a reminder to us. God says, I will make you. He's talking to Abraham, but we can apprehend this. I will make you a great nation and your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse. And in all of your families of the earth shall be blessed. And then later he tests him through that sacrifice, and he says again, I indeed will bless you. The later passages we'll talk in Genesis, like I said, about Jacob, and that's the conflicted call of God. And we're going to work through all the difficulty with that. Jacob's a scoundrel. He's a punk. You know, heel grabber. And yet God puts the name Israel on this person. It's annoying and fun all at the same time. It's like we look at our lives and go, like, how can I be used by God? How can I look back? If I were to look over my life and say, man, God, what are you going to use in my life? It's a joke. But yet, we're going to see how God does do what he promises to do. And he brings that life. And he works through the imperfect. And the question with Jacob is, will he hang on? Will he battle through? And there's that key moment where he wrestles and he will not let go of the angel until he blesses him. And the call for us as a church is to hold on, to dig in and wrestle with that brokenness. That we just know that we know that we know that God promised to bless us. And we hold on to him until that promise is fulfilled. Do not let go. do not stop wrestling. That will be the call that I'm going to call us to, and that's what I'm calling us to today. Like I said, finally we're going to work through the hidden call of God, the Joseph narratives. It's in there that we have the suspense. We see that the one who, you know, and he was even arrogant and prideful and, you know, like, oh, telling his brothers, you know, like, hey, you know, I'm the one that's going to be, you're all going to bow down to me and all this stuff. And there's maybe he was arrogant and prideful, but there's also that innocence of a kid of like, hey, check out my dream. Look at what God told me. And it incites the envy and the violence and so forth in these guys. And they send them down into Egypt. And that is the very thing that needs to happen to save and redeem. You and I don't know what's going on. You know that there's the tragedy. You know that there's like all heaven is against you, it feels like at times. And yet, in the end of it, we don't know how God is going to turn what man made meant for evil and what God made for good. You don't know that. And you don't know that unless you see it all the way through. And I'm not saying that just because you don't see it all the way through, God isn't like, because he's a good creator. And he's going to be an artist. And he's going to fix stuff and do stuff and work stuff in you. Right? Like we have evidence all over the Bible, the prodigal son being one of the classic stories of that, where the guy said, ah, screw it, I'm leaving. Boom. Right? And then he comes back into the loving arms of a God who loves him. I stole Daniel's commentary, Walter Brueggemann's thing on Genesis. It's his format that we're using. I'm just going to kind of use it as kind of a skeleton, and we'll work some things out through there. But in the middle of that, you open up his commentary, and Daniel has a picture of the prodigal son, the famous one that, what's Rembrandt. You remember that one, the famous Rembrandt, where the son is just enfolded into the father's arms. And it's just, that's our lives. He is there to enfold us. He is there to recreate us so that we can have that relationship, that connection, and that promise that he will never let you go, will sustain us for until he's ready to bring us home with the no more tears. So that's what we're going to go through. And I'm excited. And I encourage you guys, read Genesis. Ground yourself. You think that life is screwy and life is, you know, nutty and all of the fun words that, you know, we can come up with, confuzzled and, you know, confounded and all of that stuff, pick it up. Start thumbing through it. Start reading it. In the beginning, God created the heavens of the earth. Even what Danny read today was like grounding us into this reality that Christ, from the beginning, this was not like an afterthought that, you know, all of the craziness is happening. Jerusalem falling was not an afterthought in God's mind. He knew how he was going to do this thing. He already had it worked out because he had it all sketched out. He's got his own little storyboard that we don't have access to up in heaven that he's playing with and drawing and illustrating and all of this different things. And yes, we have free will in that, and we have to navigate that and negotiate it, but the encouragement is to use that free will to grab the Father's arms and just hold on tight and just see what kind of beauty he makes out of your lives. Yeah? So the point is what was that song that you guys did? I couldn't help but think that this is perfect for the beautiful. So when you're sitting in the ashes, the lament was great. I love the honesty. The honesty in the scriptures are fantastic. But this song I thought was just perfect. And it says, I see your face in every sunrise. The colors of the morning are inside your eyes. What I got to thinking as I'm listening and I'm worshiping with you guys is when you're sitting in the ashes and we go, you look at all the stuff and it's all crap and it's a mess and destruction and all of this stuff and there's loud noises and you know, racing cars and all of these different things. But then the response to us as the human is to do what? Look up. Look up. Yeah, you want to close it? He'll be done in a minute. That was good timing. We'll close with this. I see your face in every sunrise. The colors of the morning are inside your eyes. The world awakens in the light of the day. I look up to see the sky and say, you're beautiful. I see your power in the moonlight where the planets are in motion and the galaxies are bright. We are amazed in the light of the stars. It's all proclaiming who you are. I see you hanging there on a tree. You bled, and then you died, and then you rose again for me. Now you are sitting on your heavenly throne, and soon we'll be coming home. You're beautiful. And when we arrive at eternity's shore, where death is just a memory, and tears are no more, we'll enter in as the wedding bells ring, and your bride will come together, and we will sing, you're beautiful. We're going to walk through Genesis, and we're going to look into God's eyes, and we're going to see his beauty. Let's pray. God, help us to give you the ashes of our lives. Help us to surrender to you and to surrender whatever you're up to and to get our face up and to look into your eyes and to come what may know that you've got us. We love you so much. Thank you for loving us. Thank you for thinking us up. Thank you for including us in your beauty and your grace. Thank you for the purpose that you've given us simply to reflect who you are. I guess in that, I'm sorry that we mar it up sometimes and forgive us again. But I also want to say thank you for forgiving us in the middle of this prayer. Thank you that you are willing to go over and over and over again with us. Thank you for never stop calling us. We love you in your name. Amen.